Okay. Well, thank you for coming back from tea. I know this has been a long and hot day, and thank you very much for being here. And of course, thank you to Vidya and Dr. Palani and this whole fantastic organization of this extremely invigorating, intellectually invigorating workshop. We've been talking about groups and a lot of groups, but so far I think we've really been talking about largely groups consisting of single species, though of course you could have variation within the population. And today I'd like to also extend some ideas to thinking about groups that could be constructed out of several species together. I just put up this slide because I thought it was kind of interesting. You can figure out how many trophic levels there are here, and of course you have organisms of different sizes and all trying to get at a single resource. Again, one always can find everything that you want to look for, by and large, in Charles Darwin. And therefore, I pull out this quote from Darwin from The Descent of Man and Selection in Relation to Sex. And I'd like to read the quote quite slowly and carefully, so that because much of what I'm saying here will have relevance to what the system particularly that I work on, one of the systems that I work on, and I hope that we will be able to see this connection. So Darwin says, thus the fertility of each species will tend to increase, from the more fertile pairs producing a larger number of offspring, and these from their mere number will have the best chance of surviving and will transmit their tendency to greater fertility. The only check to a continued augmentation of fertility in each organism seems to be either the expenditure of more power and the greater risks run by the parents that produce a more numerous progeny, or the contingency of very numerous eggs and young therefore being produced of smaller size or less vigorous or subsequently not so well nurtured. To strike a balance in any case between the disadvantages which follow from the production of a numerous progeny and the advantages, such as the escape of at least some individuals from various dangers, is quite beyond our power of judgment. I think actually most of what we have discussed in this workshop, you know, you can find relevance in what Darwin is saying about groups, about, well, really, there are some additional issues in this quotation, but what I'd like to do in the course of my talk today is to try and show you the relevance of life history theory for a lot of how one might think about the composition of groups. Of course, Paul, I haven't done anything, Paul Rainey talked about transitions with life cycles and then brought in ecology, and in a sense has set the stage for much of what I'd like to say. Size is a fundamental parameter, and perhaps we've not really talked so much about size. We've talked a little bit about maybe size of a group, but not very much. And I think perhaps if one can build up from size, there can be many, many interesting predictions that one could make. Of course, I have the elephant here, and I had this actually for Yanni, but I don't see him here. Does anybody know what this is, especially for Yanni? This is a rock hyrax, which is very closely related to the elephant, and as you can see, the rock hyrax is really very small, and you can see perhaps 1, 2, 3, 4 offspring at any given time. So you have an elephant with one offspring every many years, maybe every 8 years, getting sexually reproductive very, very, after many, many years, certainly not like the little rock hyrax, which probably becomes sexually mature within a year or even less than that. So, of course, ecologists, evolutionary biologists, people interested in life cycles, life histories, think about life history strategies. And I've just put up some of these parameters: age at first reproduction, intervals between reproductive events, number of reproductive events, and so on. And of course, you can have a classic two extremes of the spectrum. You can have what is called iteroparity, which is when you reproduce many times during your lifespan, as opposed to semilparity, where you have just one big burst of reproduction. And of course, the classic example of this would be the Semilparis salmon, and of course the wonderful migrations of salmon that go back to their spawning ground. And here you can see the adult salmon have come back spawning, and after this gigantic spawning and reproductive event, you have the salmon die. When it's your time to go, I guess it's your time to go, and you have a salmon saying, "Here, I can accept that. It would have been nice, however, to see the kids grow up." Okay? Around us, sometime I think on the second or third day, we talked about bamboos too. And we said that yes, bamboos also have this one big burst of reproduction, a single individual bamboo clone. But we also know that related or individuals or clones that are close by in the same area also tend to simultaneously flower. So this is almost like individuals deciding as in an evolutionary decision by natural selection probably, to have this one big burst of reproduction at periodic intervals. Here we have Daniel Jansen, who wrote this very interesting paper in 1976. The title of the paper is "Why Bamboos Wait So Long to Flower." And because we are in the hills, I thought to draw your attention to this very interesting bamboo, Melocana bambusoides. And in this paper, Jansen pulls out episodes of flowering, so 1864 followed by 1911 and 1912, with an intermast interval of 47 to 48 years. And here you can see a snapshot of this area in Mizoram, where you have whole hillsides which are all flowering at the same time. And indeed, I mean, it's not only so much that they are all flowering at the same time, but that they are going to die after this one massive flowering event. And here you can see a fruit, a seed, and this causes a massive outbreak of rodents, because the rodents find the seeds highly palatable. And this actually turns back to Jansen's original idea, where he thought that it was predator satiation, a hypothesis, that perhaps these mass flowering episodes are really to satiate the seed predators. And here you can see that the rodents not only go to the bamboo, but they also feed on adjacent maize crops, destroying the agriculture. So much so, they destroy maize, rice, pineapple, they bite through mosquito nets, raising the incidence of malaria. And of course, we all know that there are deadly diseases like bubonic and pneumonic plague, which are borne by rodent fleas, which are also tied up with this one big massive group, in a sense, flowering event. Some of you might know, but I'd just like you to hazard a guess. What do you think these things are over here? Any idea?
Dead rodents.
Not dead rodents, really. Can you get a little closer? You're warm. You're very warm.
Insects.
No. They are individual rodent tails, because the way the government of Mizoram, in this last big flowering event, gave a reward for anybody who killed a rodent, and the only way you could be sure that you'd really killed it was that you had to bring your tail in. And so what this is really is a collection of rodent tails. Okay? This is quite serious, actually, and to think of how this just comes up from one big group massive flowering event, and this is really a schematic showing that at this time in 2008, which is really the last time this thing burst into flower, and it happened in areas even in Bangladesh, 5,000 metric tons of crops were lost.
How often does this happen?
So depending on the intermast interval, as I said, every bamboo species has a periodicity of flowering. So this species has a 47 to 48 year interval. Yes? And I... Yes?
Just an information. Recently, just in 2011, another bamboo flowering, massive bamboo flowering occurred in Kasar district of Assam. It is called Dolua bamboo in local language. But followed by, there is no such kind of rodent explosion of pollution as well.
I guess it depends on the size and the massive, the population which has decided now to flower, yes? And if you go back actually to look at, I just pulled out this World Atlas of Plague. It's a wonderful review which traces the history of plague throughout the world. And I pulled out the picture for India, and you can see that these are the areas where plague was, had a massive outbreak of plague. And those of us who know Indian forests will realize that these are actually areas which have got large amounts of bamboo. Yes, the central Indian plains, parts of the Western Ghats, and so it's interesting to see, of course, some of plague is also bad sanitation, etc., where it is concentrated in cities. But here, it's interesting to see how a flowering event, which is a life history, a consequence of life history strategies by a species, can have such a cascading effect on many other species. So of course, as ecologists and evolutionary biologists, we think about these life histories kind of in a R and K kind of life history continuum, where R is, the rate of increase, K is a carrying capacity, and usually we try to divide organisms, based on various criteria. If they are R strategists, they tend to be small, they have many offspring, they become reproductively mature very early, life expectancy and even lifespan is shorter, and contrasting with the so-called relatively K-selected species, which, like the elephant compared to the rock hyrax, would be very large, have very few offspring, and so on. So here, I think it's important, we've been talking a lot about bacteria, about duplication, replication, etc. When you have organisms that are, say, iteroparous or even semilparous, you could have, fitness at every reproductive event. And I think that's important. And particularly also, therefore, you should ideally be able to calculate what is called lifetime reproductive fitness. Many times, evolutionary biologists or even ecologists take snapshots of populations or individuals, and we oftentimes try to extrapolate from a snapshot of what an individual might be doing at any point in time to what really might be happening at the end of the entire reproductive lifespan. So just to introduce, I'm sure all of this is well known to all of you, but just to bring it into our short-term memory for the duration of this talk. And of course, you have an exponential growth, or you could have a K selection with some carrying capacity K. Eric Sarnoff is another very interesting man who has written a lot about life history strategies and works with insects and also tries to adopt many of the strategies and uses insect models also a lot. And here, I take this from paper by Sarnoff and Skinner, which is in your the list of papers that I've given you to refer to. And essentially, the idea is really, if you have offspring survival and yearly adult survival, then helping offspring to survive might reduce the chance that a parent will survive to reproduce again. Therefore, natural selection might favor an intermediate point, that is this point where, you know, reproductive fitness is really the greatest. So there are decisions that parents also need to make, how much to reproduce, how much to invest in offspring, how big a group should you have when you're talking about offspring. And of course, you have to couple, overlay this basic dichotomy of large to small. So I just thought I'd take this example from birds, because it's really easy to see how you have this large New Zealand moa to the very tiny hummingbird, and you can see that egg size is very large, and you have the tiny hummingbird, which has probably got one of, you know, the largest, the smallest egg size of birds on the planet. So here you've got different organisms of different sizes producing different sizes of eggs, and consequently, perhaps that might determine the type of clutches, if you want to use that term, that these organisms would want to cluster these eggs into. And it was really this very famous British ornithologist, David Lack, who wondered about this, and in his experience, in his vast experience with birds, not only did he know about birds which laid big eggs and small eggs, and consequently by life history theory, you might expect the big birds that lay big eggs will have a smaller clutch size, and the birds that lay a smaller egg size might have a larger clutch, relatively larger clutch size. But he was also interested in variation within species, where sometimes you might, early in the evolution of a species or in a species evolving under different conditions, you might have clutch sizes varying between individuals. And Lack wondered about that. And Vidya mentioned a trade-off, or the concepts of a trade-off in his talk today. And indeed, Lack's trade-off hypothesis for clutch sizes is quite appropriate for us to think about in this regard. So here he has increasing clutch size, and here you have survival to adulthood for each offspring, and here you have number of surviving offspring. And of course, as clutch size increases, the survival to adulthood of each offspring will decline, resulting in an intermediate clutch size, which maximizes the number of surviving young. Now, there are some problems with the formulation of David Lack's clutch size, you know, in the strict sense, which I won't go into today. They feed more, yes. In this particular example, they feed more, yes. So, but you can imagine that natural selection should tend to bring the clutch size to an optimum level in terms of the sibling group that is formed. Yes. Yes.
Can it be said that the center of this thing, where the curve rises up to the peak position, is it the switch position between the R and the K selected species?
No, actually.
Can you repeat the question?
This point, I think he was saying, this point, is it a switch between an R and K selected species? No, I don't really think so, but we can talk about it. So, of course, we've been talking throughout this 10 days about various reasons why groups might become larger. And I think Vishu in his talk talked about migrating wildebeest. Monish brought up this issue in Paul Rainey's talk about you might just want to secrete another organism just because, you know, you get better protection or something. So of course, if that's what I think Monish said, yes? Okay. So do you, here are eggs laid by a butterfly, for example, and you might want to ask, why cluster your eggs? Safety in numbers? Maybe just a larger queue for predators, and as you can see an ant happily consuming one of these eggs. Vishu also talked about, organisms coming closer to each other, the geometry of the selfish herd. So this is talked about the predation dilution effect. Sometimes insects also lay eggs singly. So here you have an egg here, an egg here. If you have a cluster, many times parasitoid. So now these are organisms that actually derive their sustenance by growing on another organism. So they are kind of predators, except that their offspring develop within another existing organism or larva or egg. And here you can see parasitoids actually exploiting these egg cultures and emerging from what was previously a moth or a butterfly egg. So obviously, grouping or the lack of grouping can give you some protection. On the other hand, grouping might make you more conspicuous to predators and parasitoids. If you're single, you might escape attention, but if you do get the attention of a predator or a parasitoid, you have no predator dilution effect. So in this same paper, Sharnov and Skinner talk about brookid beetle weevils, for example. And here you have brookid weevils, the female weevils, laying eggs into bean pods, okay? And here you have eggs laid per bean pod, and here you have the mean survivorship of the larva that emerges from such a cluster. And you can see that as the female brookid weevil lays more eggs into the bean pod, the survivorship starts declining. So obviously, there is something not so very good about laying too many eggs within the same pod. Similarly here, in egg parasitoids, and by an egg parasitoid I mean a parasitic wasp or a fly that lays its eggs on the eggs of other species. So here also, adults emerge at a smaller size in crowded hosts. So here, if you have the length of the emerging adult and you plot it against how many competing developing larvae were present within the egg, you can see that you have negative density dependence, and the length of the emerging adult declines as the number of progeny per host increases. Now, you might ask the question, okay, so what? The length of the emerging adult declines, what's the big issue? But we do know, and here this talks about lifetime egg production of the same small adult that emerged from a host in which there was a lot of crowding. The lifetime egg production increases with adult egg size. So if you are a smaller individual that has emerged as a result of this crowding effect, obviously the lifetime capacity for you to mature or produce eggs is going to decline, or it increases with your size. So that's one set of ideas. I come to another set of ideas which is quite important in population biology and thinking about groups of organisms. And this is a very interesting individual, Warder Ali, who was actually a professor of zoology at the University of Chicago, and wrote this very interesting book, The Social Life of Animals. And Ali actually did some not very nice experiments. I think they would not perhaps pass the ethics committee in today's... for example, he subjected goldfish to lethal concentrations of colloidal silver. And then he put 70 fish in 7 groups of 10 each. And then he isolated the same 70 in, different in as individuals. And then he looked at the average time to death in the grouped fish was 507 minutes, and that of the single isolated individuals was 182 minutes. And from this, he said, well, there is a benefit to being in a group, because obviously the amount of colloidal silver that each individual is absorbing is less. But the important point is that Ali was made some interesting comments, and he said there should be some measurable component of fitness, the probability of dying or the probability of reproducing. And this measurable component of fitness is likely to be higher in a large population. Well, there's also a little sub-quote from Darwin, where Darwin says a large stock of individuals of the same species, relative to the number of its enemies in this case, is absolutely necessary for its preservation. So, of course, people use the Ali effect a lot in conservation biology, and it's often used in conservation biology to say that if a species or a population has come down to such a small number that mate finding becomes very difficult, then quickly that population might go to extinction. So people often call or term the Ali effect as the issue of a small population size. But actually, in the original writing, Ali was really talking about the fact that for many species, there could be benefits associated with the presence of conspecifics up to a point. And then after that point, you will get a decline in any potential benefit from coming together in that group. So, of course, we all know of examples of organisms that group together. Here you have caterpillars on. Ali also. So here I just pull up one example, since we had caterpillars on the last slide. So here, if you think of the group size of these caterpillars, the same caterpillars that you saw in the earlier slide, and you might see mechanisms such as group defense, which these caterpillars also do, against predators may give rise to what is called a component Ali effect, i.e. a component of fitness that is higher in larger groups. So as you get, you're getting larger, and up to a point, yes, you are getting the advantages of being in that group. Now, whether this will result in a demographic Ali effect at the population level will, of course, depend on the strength of negative density dependent effects, such as interference between one caterpillar and another in feeding, and of course resource depletion, and therefore your overall fitness might be then this combined curve. Yes? Because you're not getting, if it's larval, it's group defense, right? So after some time, maybe after some size, it doesn't really matter how many.
I thought it should be negative after some time. The larger the group.
Yeah, the overall fitness, as I said, will come down. But a certain component of the fitness, a certain trait might be beneficial up to a certain point. So like group defense up to a certain level might be higher if you're in a group. Yeah, it's possible maybe that you could have situations. In this paper, it does describe situations where this might even come down. It's possible. Yes? Okay, so just to pull out an example, since I showed you ant predation and I showed you larvae, just again to talk about a real ecological situation and a paper by Ken Raffa's group, where here you have the aggregation size of the caterpillars, and you have this ant, Formica obscuripis, which is preying upon them. And you can see that at an aggregation size of 5, the number of larvae taken is 4. percent survival is just 17%, and at an aggregation size of 40, the percent survival is much higher. So the increased survival was due to a predation dilution effect and also to increased defensive behavior by caterpillars. Before I come to the actual system that I'm working with and give you some examples, I thought I would also introduce some other interesting ideas about resource patchiness and aggregations, and how resource patchiness and aggregations could actually lead to a stability, to a stabilization of the coexistence of many species within the same area. And this is just an example taken from one of Hofmeister's papers. Many species of Drosophila. However, females of a single species tend to aggregate for various reasons. They might aggregate on resource patches because they might meet males there, they can mate and then deposit eggs and so on and so forth. But essentially, when females are aggregating in these resource patches, this leads to increased intra-specific competition in a particular patch. Let's say it's a patch or a particular decaying fruit, and this is fruit flies in this case. So increased intra-specific competition in some patches might just leave other patches unoccupied, and this might provide competitor-free patches for other species of Drosophila in this case. And Hofmeister, in both a modeling exercise as well as looking at some real data, claims that in this way you could actually facilitate species coexistence. Yes?
If you just go back to your previous slide. Now, throughout all this meeting, we've had similar discussions. Here's a case where say, if they do such and such, they serve such and such a function. Now, is there any data that these egg-laying females consistently do this and this gives rise to coexistence?
Yeah, so that's exactly what I said. Hofmeister has modeled it, as well as these are real data. These are real data, proportion survival from egg to adult egg density, and he's actually gone out into, a forest area where there are fruits of different species, there are many different drosophilids, and he has actually found coexistence of different species. I mean, females tend to aggregate. I will also show you an example from my own work, which might...
I think I'm stuck on the following. How is this kind of statistics collected? Like, you go out and you see a certain clusters of eggs that are, you know, spatially distinct at one go, or is this a kind of behavior that is repetitively engaged in by individuals of the same species? How do you tell this?
Because you are simultaneously sampling in your... It's a simultaneous sampling, so you see that simultaneously females of one species tend to aggregate on one resource patch, females of another species tend to aggregate on another resource patch. And there are various reasons why females of a species might want to aggregate on resource patches, as I said. They might meet males there, they might engage in various mating displays. There is the whole concept also of leks. In this case, males aggregate on different resource patches and females follow the males. So there are even examples of sympatric speciation, which is a consequence of these aggregations.
I'm sorry, Vinny. I will just make one simple question. The egg density
yes.
Axis is about equally populated by these experimental dots. So you see all kinds of behavior.
Well, this is Hofmeister's curve. I'm not defending Hofmeister's curve. Yes, he's drawing a curvilinear distribution, and he's saying, yes, in a particular, it's similar, proportion survival from egg to adult, you do get, you know, an optimal density of eggs that you would want to lay in a particular patch. Yes, and following up from in this same paper, and I haven't put the data in this slide, but he does have data to show that simultaneously you have, at the same time, aggregations of females of different species. Okay, so the claim here is, and it is a claim that he's making, that this fact that females of one species tend to aggregate on an ephemeral patchy resource, in a sense, leaves out, because, you know, females of one species are all being attracted to one focus, it might therefore cause another aggregation at another focus, and so on, of another species. Okay? There was a question.
Can we say this computer free patches, like a niche separation?
You could, if you want to use the word. It's not really niche separation, because these are really the same species of fruit, for example. It's just that once a nucleus of female starts, for whatever reason, and that I will tell you more in my own system, you will get other females coming in. Of course, that happens for another reason, but we can talk about it. So it's not really niche separation. They're not using different species of fruit. They could use the same species of fruit, but it's just that females start aggregating, females of one species, and pull in other females. Okay, or there is a congregation, a conspecific congregation, leaving another area for another conspecific congregation to start.
That might be to attract, as you say, to attract, because patchiness of this particular female species together to attract the males for the mating.
Yes, there are many, many possible mechanisms.
And similarly,
can you go on?
Okay. I just want to introduce this last one before I get into the system that I'm working in. And just to also say that aging and the lifespan, because I introduced life history theory and introduced aging. So if you take organisms being in a hurry to lay their eggs because they're getting older and they're going to die and so on and so forth, and if the time that they have to search between suitable hosts starts increasing, you might find that they might tend to dump more eggs when the search time is much longer. So if they've reached a host after a longer search time, they might actually, so if this is the number of eggs, and if oviposition time is approximately equivalent to the number of eggs laid, if you've searched for a very long time and you're also aging in that process in a short-lived individual, once you've reached your host, you might just put in many more eggs, as opposed to if you've reached a suitable host in a shorter period of time. So this is another complication which I think one needs to think about when you're talking about grouping offspring or grouping eggs together. Okay, with that, I'm now going to move and talk about the system, one of the systems that I work with, and hopefully try and convince you that this is really an excellent model system to address many of the issues that have come up in this meeting about stability of groups and so on and so forth. This is a very unusual system because you have, it's a nursery pollination mutualism. And a nursery pollination mutualism means that the pollinators are reproducing in the very inflowers or the inflorescences that they are pollinating. So the plant benefits from reproduction, but the plant has to give up some of the flowers for the insects to oviposit and to provide nutrition to the larvae. The insects benefit from reproduction, and so you have kind of a win-win situation, but at the same time both partners play a cost. The plant gives up some of its ovules to provide oviposition sites, and of course the insect does not exploit all of the ovaries of the plant. Nursery pollination systems are quite interesting. They've evolved many times in the history of life on Earth. And I'm going to only, the system I work with is figs in the family Moraceae. And here you can see very reminiscent of Paul Rainey's microcosm, and I'll come to that in a moment. Here you have a syconium, which is a closed inflorescence of the fig. The only opening it has is at the top, and here you have the pollinating female wasps rushing to get in before they die. They live only 24 hours. So in 24 hours, they have to find the right fig of the right species at the right stage. So yes, this is a very, very ancient mutualism, and I'm likening this syconium to an incubator for wasps. It's also an inflorescence. This is where the wasps come in. At that time, the female flowers in a typical monoecious fig, which has male and female flowers. So the female flowers are ready to receive the pollen. The pollinating wasps oviposit, they dump their eggs. At the same time, they take care also to pollinate some of the flowers. And after this, you get both seeds. This is the wall of the fig. This is into the interior of the fig. So you get seeds as well as wasps. So this is almost like, as I said, a veritable incubator producing wasps as well as seeds. So of course, I'm sure many of you know this, but it might be useful, and it would be for the rest of my talk, to just understand a little bit about the life cycle of how this works. So you have a receptive fig. By receptive, I mean it's receptive to pollen that is brought in by a female wasp that comes in. Many wasps try to get in because this has to happen in 24 hours. There is competition also. And the wasp oviposits, etc., etc. There is development of eggs and seeds happening. And at this D phase, and this is actually a very critical phase, the male pollinators emerge first from their gall. So the female lays male offspring as well as female offspring. The male pollinators have massive mandibles. They bite out the females from their galls. They mate with them. They also cooperatively make an exit hole, as illustrated here, so that the females can leave. And before the females leave, in some species they actively gather pollen, they have pollen pockets, they stuff the pollen into their pockets, and then leave after having been mated to follow this whole cycle once again. The male wasps, poor chaps, die within the syconium that they are born in and really never see the light of day. Okay? This is a highly species-specific interaction. So here, this is just a cartoon to show you what's happening inside. You have a female ovipositing. This is an ovary. You can have wasps being produced or seeds, and usually seeds are produced in these flowers which have very, very long styles. Whereas wasps are usually produced in the ones that have the shorter styles. This is just a cartoon representation of a stigma and a style and the ovary.
Madam, can I stop?
Yes, please.
It is related to phase of the female.
Yes.
Wasp life cycle.
Yes.
And you said it last, the female lifespan is only for 24 hours.
Yes.
Yes. So once it is completed, so that means the breeding is over for the particular big species, the entire population of wasps, how do they generate again?
Oh, okay. Let me see if I understand. So the female dies after she oviposits. She oviposits, she pollinates, she dies. It's her offspring that are going to to continue this cycle. Yes, it's not her, she's dead.
No, I understood, but this fruiting phase of this particular space phase lasts only for 2 or 3 months.
Absolutely, you brought up a very interesting point, which maybe I'll come back to later, but it is interesting because this cycle will collapse if there are not some fig trees which are out of phase. So wasps from here, which are born in this syconium, have to find a favorable fig tree in the right phase for the cycle to continue. And this is actually why figs are called keystone species in forests, because even though other fruiting tree species will not bear fruit, figs must, in a sense, continue to cycle their wasps. They can cycle them within the same tree, which is not a very good idea, or they can cycle them between trees. Yes?
Yeah, this is a comment.
Yes.
In the cultural program we had here, there was a song, Bedu Pako Baramasa, which means figs ripe every month. It's found throughout the year.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yes, thank you for that. Okay, so I don't want to get into too much about conflict resolution. Somebody mentioned conflict resolution, I think Paul Rainey in his life cycle and other people also. But just very quickly to talk about, there are many ways in which this conflict between fig and wasp could be resolved. As I said, a wasp does not want to overexploit a fig, and a fig requires to pay some cost. And there are things like short ovipositor, insufficient eggs, unbeatable seed, some spatial constraints, ovule profitability, etc., etc. So if necessary, I will come back to this if anybody has questions, but I don't want to talk too much about mechanisms that people are postulating and appear to find in their particular system that actually tends to stabilize this mutualism. So assuming that this mutualism is stabilized between a fig and a pollinating fig wasp, and that all is well at least up to that point, so this is a species that I work on, which is the model system, Ficus racemosa. And assuming that all is well, even in all is well situation, you can still get trouble in paradise, of course. And the trouble in this so-called paradise is other complicating factors. And here you have the other complicating factors are these non-pollinating fig wasps. And here you see an aggregation of one species. And in this case, the non-pollinating fig wasps are actually ovipositing from the exterior. So they are not getting into the fig like the pollinating fig wasps. In the pollinating fig wasps, a female cannot escape the fig that she gets into. So for her, it becomes a tomb blossom. Whereas for these other ones, they can lay their eggs in this fig or in that fig, or fly away and lay it in another fig, because they are laying their eggs from the outside. Okay? We also have other complicating agents like ants that I might talk about later. Okay, so because this is about multitrophic interactions, and Ficus racemosa is really a wonderful model system because it has 7 species. You have a pollinator, which is also a gauler. You have 3 other gaulers. You have 3 species of parasitoids. So you have several species interacting with this system. These are very, very tiny wasps, okay? Extremely tiny, and just to show you the suspects. So these are all the males, which are wingless, and these are all the females. Interestingly, as I said, the syconium develops from a very small to large when the seeds are produced and becomes the sort of fig that you and I are familiar with in terms of eating. And the different wasps. So here you have the different wasps and their oviposition windows, so to speak. And the different wasps are coming in at different times of the syconium development phase to oviposit. Some have longer oviposition windows, some have shorter. Some even come before the pollinator has come in, and this is when the pollinator comes in the receptive phase. some are even parasitizing the fig and therefore using up resources that the pollinator would have used or that the seeds would have used even before the pollinator has got there. Now, I might just add that figs have each syconium besides all the other methods of conflict resolution that we've talked about. From our own work, we have been able to show that if a fig is excessively parasitized, either by any one of these species or even by the pollinator, that individual syconium is aborted. So the fig seems to sense, the individual syconium senses that the level of parasitism is beyond a certain threshold, and we don't understand this process, and that fig aborts. Another, yes.
Do I understand that this species, as Ramosa, is not species specific wasp? Because many of the fig species are known that only one species of wasp will be able to pollinate. This one, is it many species that pollinate or all
no,
others?
No.
All others are parasitized.
The others are non pollinating fig wasps. They are either gallers or they are parasitoids. There is only one species of pollinator. Yes. Another point I had forgotten to mention is another interesting way, perhaps, to also control excessive parasitism within this microcosm is, if you remember, I had told you that the male pollinator wasps cooperate to dig this exit tunnel for the females. The male non-pollinating wasps cannot do this. So if any of these non-pollinating wasps over-exploit a fig and kill all, even the male pollinators by preying upon them as parasitoids, they will essentially, their offspring will never be able to leave the syconium. And very, very occasionally, we do find such syconia where there are no male pollinators. Consequently, all the wasps have died inside. Okay, so just a schematic, just to show you, yes, you can have gallers. This is an individual fig flower which might get galled and the larva of a pollinator or a non-pollinator might develop in it. Then you might have a parasitoid where the parasitoid lays its egg on the developing larva. We don't need to get into these technical terms. You can have inquilines and idiobionts and all that. Anyway, suffice to say that there is several different trophic levels and a lot of complicated stuff going on. Okay? Just to come back a little bit to this idea that each fig is a unit, and in this unit you have competition, all sorts of things being played out. So you've got the pollinator coming from the inside and she's laying eggs, and you have these others coming from the outside, and there are sites that are occupied, sites that are not occupied. There is an exquisite level of complexity which maybe we can discuss this, and how this can lead to stability. We can talk about that later. Yeah, Harika. When we look at figs across a syconia, we find in general seeds occupy about 56% of flowers, the pollinators roughly 17%, though we do get some syconia where there are quite a lot more, and we have others. Some of the non-pollinating fig wasps are actually quite abundant, but they have a fair amount of variance between syconia in their representation. To now try and tie this up into the life history strategies that I talked to you about and the consequences of... So we've looked at survivorship and survivorship. Longevity is an important correlate of life history strategies. And if you've got survivorship in days on this axis, survivorship, say, with sucrose or water regimes, you will find that whatever you do, you cannot increase the survivorship of the pollinator. The pollinator is in a sense, perhaps programmed to die within 24 hours. The pollinator has no feeding mouth parts, it cannot really feed. But the other species, particularly the parasitoids, can indeed live for up to 25 days if we supplement them with sucrose. And in the wild, we know that these parasitoids, or even some of the gallers, are probably feeding on natural floral nectars or extra floral nectars and sources of sucrose. So we have a variation in this community, even at the level of the survivorship and therefore the longevity of these species. And just to summarize, this whole community in the sense of the same RNK continuum. So you have the early arriving ones, which are gallers, and the parasitoids, which come later, and you have the pollinator, which comes sort of in between. And the early arriving ones come ready with all their eggs matured. They have no time, they are short-lived, they have no time to mature eggs as their lifespan goes on, because they just live for a day or 2 days. So they are born with a full complement of eggs. However, the late arriving ones are born or eclose with a very small number of eggs, which means that they progressively mature their eggs as their lifespan progresses. So these are the short lifespans, these are the long lifespans, and so on and so forth. So you have a continuum, you have a very nice gradation. And just to show you, these are some of the egg progressively maturing eggs of the parasitoids, which mature their eggs throughout the lifespan. The gallers are born with their full complement of mature eggs. Consequently, you can imagine that a short-living gauler, short-lived gauler, would really be in a big rush to get to a good host, and as it's aging, and it's aging very fast, it would need to perhaps dump a lot of its eggs quickly if it doesn't get, if it takes a very long time to get to a host. So there have been models, and I don't have the time to get into this, that indicate that exploiters of mutualisms are able to persist only when exploiters can disperse to patches. There are a lot of critical life history traits, as I said, which are important in distinguishing between the different players in this game. The later exploiters are longer lived, they have larger eggs, and they mature their eggs progressively. There's another player in the game. There are ants, of course. And I just come to this one particular species. And as you can see, we talked about forming groups and the benefit of the predator dilution effect. We have one wasp here. Does everybody see this wasp here? And it's in a big cluster. There are these ferocious Ecophylla ants, but the Ecophylla ants do not see this wasp. And we believe it's a case of chemical camouflage that we are getting into, and I don't have the time to talk about it. But this is the wasp, Apocryptophagus fusca. And what I will show you in the next few slides is work that we are doing with Apocryptophagus fusca in terms of its aggregation. So Apocryptophagus fusca can be in large clusters on figs and still escape predatory effects. So it's really, in a sense, hiding in plain sight. So this is work that one of my PhD students is doing even as I speak. She is literally doing these experiments while I'm here, but I'm showing you some preliminary results that we have got. So here, if we want to ask the question, which group of figs does Apocryptophagus fusca prefer to join for oviposition? And I must just tell you at this point that Apocryptophagus fusca comes at the same time for oviposition as the pollinator. So the pollinator and Apocryptophagus fusca, which is a non-pollinator, come for oviposition at the same time. So here, generally, we do bagging experiments so that we enclose figs in bags that allow the figs to breathe, of course, and these are done on the tree in situ. And we create different conditions. So we have one bunch, for example, unexposed to oviposition, nothing has oviposited. Another bunch where Apocryptophagus fusca has oviposited. Another bunch where the pollinator has oviposited. And then we allow Apocryptophagus fusca females, we expose them to these different types of figs. And we measure the time taken for an individual Apocryptophagus female to oviposit. And you can see that when nothing has oviposited, these are not, no wasp has entered a fig, these are unexposed figs, the fusca will not oviposit. We have to shut down the experiment after 30 minutes. If it has been exposed to a pollinator, so there is something that the fusca likes about figs exposed to a pollinator, they will oviposit. But the minimum time here is taken when the fusca has got a signal of some other fusca females that have already oviposited into the fig.
Nazgul?
Yes.
How do you expose it only to one wasp?
Oh, we collect fuscas and put them in, into the bags.
Okay.
Yes, so these are difficult experiments to do. So, of course, you can see that when it's unexposed, they're really not interested, and the least one is when they're exposed to oviposition by fusca. Now, you might ask the question, well, why are they interested in figs in which the pollinator has already oviposited? Aren't they competing, in a sense, with the pollinator? But as I told you, the syconium will abort if pollination hasn't happened. So individual syconia are sensitive to pollination. If fusca oviposits into a fig into which a pollinator has not already oviposited, the chance of that syconium aborting is very high. Okay? We did some further experiments where we also put both combined fusca and pollinator exposed, and you can see that the time comes down still further. So fusca likes to know that other members of its own species have laid eggs there, and the pollinator. So you might ask, again, why might this happen? And this is again a very peculiar function of the fig syconium being a nursery for the offspring. The offspring will only mate within the nursery. They do not mate outside the nursery. Which means that if a fusca oviposits into a syconium in which no other fusca has oviposited, its offspring will have to mate with, there will be a lot of inbreeding going on because any sons that it might lay will have to mate with its daughters. Or it may just never, and if it, you know, gets parasitized, for example, it will have very, very low reproductive success. So obviously fusca has to be sensitive to the presence of other fusca as well as the presence of pollinators, because this has to be, both conditions have to be satisfied for this to continue. We've done some experiments where we've looked at cues, volatile profiles, looked at different, the chemistry of the volatiles, and we are still in the process of trying to find out which cues fusca is using. But one thing we also did is, do the fig wasps, for example, deposit an oviposition marking pheromone? So we've done experiments where we've excised ovipositors and allowed intact ovipositors, and then have looked at when fusca has just been allowed to walk on the figs and not oviposit, as opposed to fusca actually ovipositing. And even fusca just walking on a fig is sufficient to incite other fusca to actually oviposit into these figs. Which leads us to believe that there could be, and as we know perhaps in other species, there may be chemical footprints So different species of different wasps are actually leaving imprints from tarsal glands on the fig, and perhaps those imprints of the tarsal glands are giving subsequent Fusca females signals as to who has already oviposited inside this syconium. So this is, as I said, very much a work in progress, and we are trying to figure out if there is a threshold of occupied sites and so on and so forth. And we also know that Fusca lives just for, we can push Fusca longevity to about 5 days. So we hope within 5 days we can do experiments with aging Fusca and newly, freshly eclosed Fusca and see you know, what type of results. So now, in absolutely the last couple of points I want to make is, now to look at this system as a part of a larger landscape. Fig trees in the wild, we are very used to planted fig trees along roadsides, etc., etc. And we often have the misconception, particularly in India, where the fig tree is sacred and many fig trees are sacred, that fig trees are quite common. But in the real world, really, in real landscapes, fig trees are rather rare. So if this is my Ficus racemosa, which is Coliflorus, and these are all other trees, fig trees are rare. And again, if you think about this business of this aggregation of females that I was talking about, where females of one species want to be where females of another species have already aggregated, and you couple it with this business of if you're aging, then you want to dump your eggs faster. We feel that this system offers us enormous possibilities to do a lot of interesting work to try and figure out how are these various, within each syconium, what are the dynamics of how many species can effectively coexist within a single syconium, and how many species can effectively coexist as a group, perhaps, over a larger landscape. Yes, so just to tell you that, yes, different things are happening at different parts of this fig phenology. To end really with the point that was made about how do the wasps cycle. And yes, another one of my PhD students is looking at the synchrony of these phases within a tree and between trees. So in a single fig, different bunches within the same bunch, are all the syconia in the same phase, in different phases? So how indeed might this dynamic influence the aggregation of different species on and in the syconium with all the aggregation pheromones and the fact that females need their offspring to find mates when they come out of their gauze, otherwise their fitness will be zero. So therefore, if social facilitation influences oviposition into individual syconia, and I've shown you the preliminary data that we have, that indeed, yes, females of one species prefer to oviposite into syconia into which females of the same species have oviposited, perhaps this gives us a way of understanding how, you know, this community of seven wasp species can actually continue to populate these microcosms at a small level and also at, you know, a much larger landscape level. And therefore, of course, this might, the coexistence and the stability of species in a multi-trophic interaction system could be ensured. So I'll end with that and happy to take questions. Yes.
Does flowering on single nighttime has got any advantages
to this plant? So the question was, does the mass flowering in bamboo have any advantage? The advantage that, or the hypothesis that Janssen provides, and many people people provide for the Semmelweis life history strategy is really you satiate your predators. So if bamboo seeds are so delicious and so, you know, many predators like them a lot. However, there are some bamboos that are quite toxic and cyanogenic. Many bamboos have, they produce cyanogenic compounds. Now it would be interesting, and I don't know enough about the variation within bamboos, you know, across bamboo species. It could very well be that if you are a toxic bamboo and you load your seed with a lot of nasty stuff, then you are protected from a seed predator, unless the seed predator has evolved to deal with your toxins, yes? And then you can flower in an iteroparous fashion. You can flower like any other plant every year, every 5 years, every, you know, you don't need to have these long intervals. So I guess these are different strategies along a continuum. If you're not toxic, you haven't evolved toxic cyanogenic glycosides, then, and you're very, very nutritious and delicious to rats and all sorts of other predators, then you, you know, put it all in one big boom so that hopefully your rats can't keep up with that and, you know, some of your progeny will survive to start the whole cycle once again. Yes?
So I don't know if I got the experimental design wrong again, but the experiment where you show that the wasp chooses the one where their conspecifics have already overvisited, could it be that, you know, it just uses the chemical signals as a cue for finding Cyconia?
Could you repeat that question then?
Let me see if I understand your question. So maybe you can repeat it.
So you showed an experiment where you found that the wasp chose Cyconia and which other conspecifics had already oviposited. And you said it could be because, you know, the reason it does that is because it provides mating opportunities. But I was wondering if it can be explained just in terms of chemical cues, and does the wasp just use chemical cues to find Cyconia?
Oh, okay. So we take Cyconia at the same stage. So our unexposed control are those because the wasps, Aphusca and the pollinator, they arrive at the same time. So we take figs that are in B phase and that are producing the same chemical cues, assuming, you know. So if we take unexposed wasps, unexposed Cyconia that have not been exposed to either the pollinator or the Aphusca, the Aphusca are not interested. So it seems like they are getting the same stage, because we've done a lot of work on how the chemistry of the Cyconium in terms of its volatile production changes. But the interesting thing is that we have not really done it by excluding all other species. We can exclude other species, but we can't exclude the pollinator, because if we exclude the pollinator, the figs will abort. So we can do this up to the B phase, but we cannot take it after the B phase by, you know, I mean, not putting anything else in. Do you see what I'm trying to say? Yes.
This is more of a comment in connection with the predator satiation hypothesis of Janssen.
Yes.
Probably it applies to bamboo, because a few years back, another Semmelweis species, Strobilanthus kuntiana, which flowered in South India, Karnataka and Kerala, we did some work on that one. There is not much of predation of the seeds. In fact, lots of seeds were produced and they fell below the plants, and only a small proportion of them were destroyed by predators. And next monsoon, most of those seeds were germinated, and again that area was filled with new plants.
Okay, so you're saying it may not entirely be applicable?
It may not be for all Semmelweis species. It may be.
Could be. Or, of course, I hate to sound like an adaptationist right now. It is also possible, as we know, in much in many of our communities, the local fauna have been severely depleted. So the original possible seed predators, which might have evolved with the Strobilanthus. See, this is always the problem we have. As I said, I don't want to sound adaptationist and to defend this particular theory, but that's something that you perhaps need to keep in mind. Yes.
How does the rat population know that this thing is going to be going into this splurge?
They don't know. They don't know. They just respond to the rats are very quick breeders. So they breed very fast, and then it takes. And you, I mean, even though, you know, there's slight, maybe a month or so, a little bit of, you know, lag. I mean, it's not as if everybody starts flowering exactly on the same day. I mean, it is 47, 48 years, or 60 years, or 75 years in some species in terms of the interval. Yes, but since not everything happens at the same time. The rats build up the population. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so the pollinator species, surely the fig and the pollinator must have evolved some way of trying to get rid of all these non-pollinating wasps. Is there something like that?
Well, yes, that's what we're trying to figure, because so far everybody has just only investigated, you know. One way that a fig and a pollinator can do this, perhaps, is a fig can get bigger, because if a fig gets bigger, wasps can be protected within what is called an enemy-free space. But then the ovipositors of the non-pollinating fig wasps are also getting longer. So in our system, we claim, or we know, that there is really no good enemy-free space. However, there are a lot of predators of the non-pollinators, except for A. fusca. So something is also, you know, there are other factors also controlling the system, perhaps. And also this patchiness coupled with differences in longevity. So I think it's a complex. But certainly, the bigger figs also contain a higher diversity of these non-pollinating fig wasps, because the idea is that if you're bigger, then you have, you know, more types of resources that can be accessible, not accessible, and of course the evolution should be towards becoming a bigger cyconium. Yes.
My question is, what was the reason for evolution of a cyconium, basically? I don't think any relative advantage of becoming a cyconium or a hypanthodium. And I probably believe that they were made for each other, for the fig and fig van. And another question is, what is the role of nectar in a ripe fig fruit?
Okay, maybe I'll answer the second question first. There's no role of nectar. There's none. It's interesting, people have tried to address the first question, how did the fig become a closed cyconium? And people have traced the history of evolution of flowers in the Moraceae and have shown that how the original flower was really flat, and have shown, hypothesized, different stages with relatives that do indeed show this phenotype of how slowly the inflorescence starts closing up. Of course, people also believe that most mutualisms originated as parasitisms and then slowly evolved into mutualisms once the conflicts were resolved.
So, you know the experiment that you showed where you have the wasp landing on the figs? Did you do the thing where they have an option in between them, because you said you cut the wasps and put them in the bag? So is it that you have, for example, ones which have been oviposited into by the pollinators and then by the same species?
Yes, yes. We give them choices also. And also, interestingly, now we are really doing more micro work even on a fixed cyconium. We find that the same sites, even on a single cyconium, the same sites are not reused, in the sense if wasp A has oviposited and injected its egg or its ovipositor into one site, the other coming wasps avoid that site and oviposit. So we are now designing experiments to actually quantify how they recognize these oviposition sites in the first place, and how much of avoidance and distance away will they oviposit into.
And secondly, to come back to what she was talking about, when you have, you know, you have a certain density of eggs, which is optimal. So is that you have a certain density of larvae, which is optimal for survival, or is it that the eggs are creating a microenvironment on that resource patch?
A certain density of eggs. So each egg occupies one flower.
I'm coming back to the Drosophila.
The Drosophila. Sorry. Yes. Yes.
So in that, when you say you have an optimum density, you know why that is? Why you have an optimum density?
Oh, I guess because the Drosophila larvae will grow and deplete their resources. And, you know, if you have more larvae, there'll be crowding, and crowding leads to smaller Drosophila, and smaller Drosophila will lead to smaller adult lifetime reproductive success.
This might be a silly question, but the flies have a way of counting this many eggs are already here. And
I don't think they need to count. They need to just sense a gradient of, that's the oviposition marking pheromone, or they need to be able to use.
So there's a chemical signal.
There should be, yes.
Okay, Jacques, quick, brief question, please.
Yeah. It's a naive question, but about this Drosophila stuff, you said that Hofmeyer hypothesizes that this leaves the place for the fact that the Drosophila of the same species, they concentrate on the same patches, leaves the place for a multi-species utilization of the space. But what would be the advantage for the species, for one species, to leave place for other species in the context of other species?
I understand. But I'm sure that this is dependent on the resource patchiness and the size of the patch in relation to the population density of an individual species. So if an individual species is not very abundant, and relative to the availability of the resource patches. So of course it is dependent on patch size, patch density, and the population size and population density of the Drosophila. Yes? Okay, that's my last slide. I have to put it up because I think the Indians in the audience will realize why I've done this, and maybe which group do you want to join? And you can choose based on size. These are political groups, of course. This is Lakshman, is a very very famous cartoonist in India. And this is the common man. So the common man is deciding which group he wants to join. And maybe all the political groups can probably, you know, you can categorize them based on all of these traits and do interesting evolutionary dynamics on them.
Thanks, Renee. Before we break up, Kruti has something to say.
Okay,